put a glass of sugar water on a bench and send a beam of polarized light through it. It comes out the far side with its plane of polarization twisted, always the same way round, always clockwise. Every glass, every kitchen, every time. Which means every sugar molecule in that water is the same hand. Not most, all. And the laws that built them, the Coulomb force, the Schrödinger equation, the whole of quantum electrodynamics, do not know left from right. They have no preference at all. Yet ammonia, a smaller molecule, obeys that rule perfectly. It flatly refuses to have a hand. Same law, two opposite answers. And the only thing that changed is how many atoms you have.
I want to stay in that glass of water, because what you have described is not a curiosity. It is a violated theorem, a real one, provable in about four lines. It says, if the Hamiltonian of a system is unchanged when you reflect space in a mirror, then any non-degenerate stationary state of that system, any state that sits there without evolving and is alone at its energy, must itself be either even or odd under that mirror. It must have a definite parity. And a state with definite parity is its own mirror image up to a sign, which means it cannot be left-handed and it cannot be right-handed. It also cannot have an electric dipole moment. Ammonia obeys that theorem exactly, and we have measured it obeying it. Sucrose, table sugar, does not, and you can see the disobedience with a torch and a piece of Polaroid.
Then either the theorem is wrong, which I doubt, or it is quietly doing less work than it appears to. So let me be suspicious in the right place. Which word in that theorem is carrying the trick?
The word is stationary. The theorem does not say a molecule cannot be handed. It says a handed molecule cannot sit still forever. A handed state is not an energy eigenstate. It is a superposition of two eigenstates close together in energy, and therefore it evolves. It oscillates back and forth between the two hands at a rate set by how close those levels are. So the theorem is really a statement about time. Handedness is allowed. It is just supposed to be temporary. And now the question becomes quantitative. Temporary for how long? For ammonia, tens of picoseconds. For sugar, a number so large that longer than the age of the universe badly undersells it, and I will show you exactly where that comes from. And somewhere between a molecule of four atoms and a molecule of 45, temporary turns into permanent, and a symmetry of the laws stops being a symmetry of the world.
So this is not philosophy. This is an actual number, in actual seconds, that runs away from us as the system gets bigger.
It is a number in seconds, and the way it runs away is the most important scaling in this series. Philip Anderson put that example in front of the physics community and said, look at what that means. So let me take us to his paper. It is the frame for the next 12 hours.
This is the 1972 paper.
The 4th of August, 1972, in Science. Philip Warren Anderson at Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey. The title is More is Different, and the subtitle is The Part People Forget. Broken Symmetry and the Nature of the Hierarchical Structure of Science. He would win the Nobel Prize 5 years later. And the paper opens by conceding almost everything to his opponent. He writes, verbatim, the reductionist hypothesis may still be a topic for controversy among philosophers, but among the great majority of active scientists, I think it is accepted without question. He accepts it too. Everything is made of the same stuff, obeying the same laws, and he is not going to argue about it.
Which makes whatever comes next much harder to dismiss, because he has not left himself an escape route.
He has not. And here is the move, again verbatim. The main fallacy in this kind of thinking is that the reductionist hypothesis does not by any means imply a constructionist one. The ability to reduce everything to simple fundamental laws does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe. And then, the sentence the paper is remembered for. The constructionist hypothesis breaks down when confronted with the twin difficulties of scale and complexity. Notice there are two difficulties named, not one. Scale is the number of particles. Complexity is the structure they arrange themselves into. They are different problems and they compound.
Let me make sure I have the shape of the claim, because it is easy to hear it as softer than it is. He is not saying reduction is true, but reconstruction is inconvenient. He is saying reduction and reconstruction are different claims, and only one has been established.
That is exactly it, and it is why the paper still gets argued about. The one-way street. He writes that the relationship between a system and its parts is intellectually a one-way street. Analysis works. You can always take the thing apart. Synthesis does not follow, and he backs it with a table that made a lot of people angry. He lays the sciences out in a ladder, and the rule is, the elementary entities of science X obey the laws of science Y. Many-body physics sits above elementary particle physics, chemistry above many-body physics, and on up the ladder until you reach psychology and the social sciences.
And the anger comes from people reading that ladder as a ranking.
From both directions, actually. But Anderson's point about the ladder is the opposite of a ranking. He writes, but this hierarchy does not imply that science X is just applied Y. At each stage, entirely new laws, concepts, and generalizations are necessary, requiring inspiration and creativity to just as great a degree as in the previous one. And then the line that people quote at dinner parties. Psychology is not applied biology, nor is biology applied chemistry.
I want to push on this, because so far it is an assertion. A very quotable one, but an assertion. Somebody could reply, of course we cannot compute a mouse from quarks, but that is a limit on our computers and our patience, not a statement about nature. Where does Anderson show it is about nature?
He shows it with the ammonia molecule. That is why he chose it. It is the smallest, cleanest, most fully solved system where you can watch a symmetry of the laws stop being a symmetry of the state, purely because the system got bigger. There is no computational excuse available. Nobody is confused about the Hamiltonian of ammonia, and nobody is confused about the Hamiltonian of sucrose. The change is in the size, and only in the size. So let us do the molecule properly. Everything else in this course is a variation on it.
Build me the picture first. What does ammonia look like, physically?
An umbrella. Three hydrogen atoms at the corners of a flat triangle, one nitrogen perched above the middle of it, like the point of an umbrella above its ribs. The nitrogen pulls electrons towards itself, so it sits at the negative end, and the hydrogens at the positive end. The molecule has an electric dipole moment along the umbrella's axis. Now the trick. That umbrella has a mirror image. Put the nitrogen the same distance below the triangle. Exactly as good a configuration, exactly the same energy. It has to be, because the forces holding it together do not know up from down.
So there are two of them. Degenerate, mirror images, and a real ammonia molecule is sitting in one of them.
That is the natural thing to say, and it is wrong in a very instructive way. The two configurations are not isolated from each other. To go from umbrella up to umbrella down, the nitrogen has to pass through the plane of the three hydrogens. It turns inside out, like an umbrella in a gale. That flat configuration costs energy. It is the top of a hill between two valleys. And the height of that hill has been measured, about 2,000 inverse centimetres, which in friendlier units is a quarter of an electron volt.
And in its ground state, the molecule does not have a quarter of an electron volt to spend. So classically, it is stuck in whichever valley it started in.
Classically stuck forever. Quantum mechanically, not stuck at all. The nitrogen's wave function does not stop at the hill, it leaks through. Anderson's phrase, the nitrogen can leak through the triangle of hydrogens to the other side, turning the pyramid inside out. and once the two valleys are connected, however feebly, you have a two-level system, and the tunneling amplitude between the wells lifts the degeneracy.
So the two states get pushed apart. Let me guess before you tell me, because this is a two-state problem. If the coupling between two degenerate states is some amplitude, the eigenstates are the even and odd combinations, up plus down and up minus down, split by twice that amplitude, one below the original energy, one above.
That is exactly right, and it is worth pausing on what each combination is. The even one, up plus down, is the lower. The nitrogen is genuinely, simultaneously above and below the triangle, with equal weight. No preferred direction, and therefore no dipole moment. Anderson's sentence, a truly stationary state, can only be an equal superposition of the unsymmetrical pyramid and its inverse. That mixture does not have a dipole moment. The odd combination, up minus down, sits just above it and has no dipole moment either.
So, the ground state of ammonia is a molecule that has not made up its mind and cannot be made to make up its mind, because making up its mind would cost energy.
It would cost exactly half the splitting. And now the number, which is the reason ammonia is famous, that splitting between the even and odd states, is about 8/10 of an inverse centimeter. Translate that into a frequency, and you get about 24 gigahertz, a microwave. It was predicted in 1932 and measured in 1934 by Cleeton and Williams, who pushed microwaves through ammonia gas and saw the absorption. The first microwave absorption spectrum anybody ever took.
Give me the time, though. You promised the physics was about time. What is the flipping rate?
Take the reciprocal. 24 gigahertz is a period of about 40 picoseconds. So the nitrogen goes from decisively up to decisively down and back roughly 24 billion times a second. Anderson quotes about 3 times 10 to the 10th per second, the same number, rounded generously. So prepare an ammonia molecule as a clean upward umbrella, and it is a clean downward umbrella 20 picoseconds later, and back again 20 picoseconds after that, forever.
And that is genuinely measured, not inferred. A picture that neat could easily be a cartoon.
It is measured, and better than that, it was engineered. In 1954 at Columbia, James Gordon, Herbert Zeiger, and Charles Townes took a beam of ammonia molecules and passed it through a shaped electric field that deflected the upper state one way and the lower state the other, because the two respond differently to a field, and threw the lower state away. That left a beam of molecules all in the upper level of the doublet. They fed it into a metal cavity tuned to just under 24 gigahertz, and the molecules dumped their energy into the cavity in phase. That is the first maser. Microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. The whole device runs on the tunneling splitting of an umbrella turning inside out.
So the first maser in history is a machine built out of a symmetry that has not been broken. Better fact than I expected.
And it hands us the hinge of the whole conversation for free, because I glossed over something. I said the field deflected the two states differently. The stationary states of ammonia have no dipole moment. That was the theorem. But ammonia in an electric field behaves like a dipole. Every chemistry textbook lists ammonia's dipole moment as about 1.5 dB. Both things are true. How?
Because the field changes what the stationary states are. It mixes the even and the odd combination back together.
Exactly. And it comes down to a competition between two energies. On one side, the tunneling splitting, what the molecule saves by staying symmetric and undecided. On the other, what it would save by lining its dipole up with the applied field. Those two fight. If the splitting wins, the eigenstates stay symmetric and the molecule has no dipole. If the field wins, the eigenstates become the localized umbrellas again, up in one case, down in the other, and the molecule is an ordinary dipole.
So there is a crossover field, and I can estimate it. I take the splitting energy and divide it by the dipole moment.
Do that, and you get about 30 kilovolts per centimeter, which is a real field. Large, but people apply it every day across a pair of electrodes in a molecular beam machine. So ammonia sits in an interesting place. Its splitting is big enough to defend itself against most stray fields, and small enough that a determined experimentalist can beat it. Here is another way to feel the same number. The splitting, expressed as a temperature, is about 1 Kelvin. Room temperature is 300 Kelvin.
Wait, if the splitting is 1 Kelvin and the room is 300, then in a bottle of ammonia there is no meaningful energy difference between the two levels at all. Both are populated. Every molecule is sloshing through both.
Every molecule constantly, and that is precisely why ammonia is the clean case. Nothing in its ordinary environment is anywhere near strong enough to freeze it into one hand. Now hold that competition in your head. Splitting versus perturbation, tunneling versus anything that tries to localize. Because for the rest of this series, we are going to do exactly one thing to it. We are going to drive the splitting to zero by making the system bigger. Everything else follows.
Then let us make it bigger. What is the first step up from ammonia?
Before I answer, guess with me, because you can. What could the tunneling rate possibly depend on? A particle of some mass under a barrier of some height, of some width. That is the whole list. Now, heavier particle, harder or easier to tunnel?
Harder, heavier things are more classical. Higher barrier, harder, wider barrier, harder. And the dependence will not be gentle because tunneling is an exponential business. The wave function decays under the barrier, so the amplitude out the far side is an exponential of something.
That is the whole answer, and you got it without an integral. The tunneling amplitude is an exponential of minus, a quantity built from all three. Roughly the square root of the mass times the barrier height, and then all of that multiplied by the width. Mass, barrier, and width do not add up in the answer. They add up in the exponent. So doubling the mass does not halve the rate. It multiplies the exponent by the square root of 2, and the rate falls off a cliff. I am skipping the derivation, the standard simplex estimate, and what it would have shown you is exactly this exponent, and a prefactor that nobody cares about.
Fine, so the experiment writes itself. Keep the shape, swap the nitrogen for something heavier.
Phosphine. Same umbrella, phosphorus instead of nitrogen, roughly twice the mass. Anderson, in the paper, says phosphine inverts at 1/10 of the ammonia frequency. That number is wrong, wrong by at least 9 orders of magnitude, in the direction that makes his argument stronger. And it was already known to be wrong when he wrote it. The published estimates going back to the 50s said the splitting was far too small to see, and searches for the phosphine doublet had already failed several times over. It was a slip, not the state of the art. He bins phosphorus trifluoride correctly in his very next sentence. Phosphine's barrier is not 2,000 inverse centimeters like ammonia's. It is roughly 6 times that, 11 to 12,500, depending on whose calculation you take, and wider. The splitting has never been observed after more than 80 years of hunting. The best modern calculation from Sousa, Silva, Tennyson and Yurchenko in 2016 puts it below 10 to the minus 10 inverse centimeters.
Convert that for me. I have no feel for 10 to the minus 10 inverse centimeters.
A few hertz at most, possibly far less. So ammonia turns itself inside out about 24 billion times a second, and phosphine, the same molecule with one atom swapped, turns itself inside out at most a couple of times a second. One substitution, a factor of 10 billion at minimum. That is what "it lives in the exponent" buys you.
And Anderson's next step in the paper is a molecule that is not one atom heavier, but a whole molecule bigger.
Sugar. He writes, We may then go on to more complicated molecules, such as sugar, with about 40 atoms. Sucrose has 45, so he was close. And think what inversion would even mean. It is not one atom hopping through a plane. To turn a sugar molecule into its mirror image by tunneling, essentially the entire skeleton has to move. Every carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen traveling to its mirrored position at once, coherently, under a barrier. The effective mass in that exponent is not one nitrogen. It is the whole molecular rearrangement, and the path length is the whole reorganization.
So the exponent is not slightly bigger. It grows roughly in proportion to the size of the molecule, and the rate falls exponentially with size. And let me cash the promise from the top. One substitution bought 10 orders of magnitude. Ammonia flips in 20 picoseconds, so 10 orders of magnitude takes me to a fifth of a second, and the age of the universe is around 10 to the 18 seconds. So I need 18 more orders of magnitude, and I have 40 more atoms to spend. It is not close.
That is the sentence to carry out of today. And Anderson's own conclusion is flat and final. Every sugar molecule made by a living organism is spiral in the same sense, and they never invert, either by quantum mechanical tunneling or even under thermal agitation at normal temperatures. At this point, we must forget about the possibility of inversion and ignore the parity symmetry. The symmetry laws have been not repealed, but broken.
Not repealed, but broken. Say what that distinction is doing, because it is precise, and I want it right.
Repealed would mean the Hamiltonian is not mirror symmetric. That is false. A sugar molecule's Hamiltonian is exactly as mirror symmetric as ammonia's. There is not a single term in it that distinguishes left from right, with one exception too small to matter here, the weak interaction, which does violate parity, and which Anderson notes is far too feeble to affect ordinary matter. Broken means the Hamiltonian keeps its symmetry and the state does not. And the state does not because the two symmetric options have become so nearly degenerate and so utterly disconnected dynamically that the system is free to sit in one of them and never find out that the other exists. The symmetry survives as a statement about the pair of states. For every left-handed sugar, there is a right-handed sugar with identical energy. But it has stopped being a property of any actual molecule you can pick up.
I want to be difficult, because this argument is doing more work than it has earned. You have shown me the splitting gets very small. Small is not zero. At any finite size, the theorem still holds. The true ground state is still symmetric, still has no handedness. So strictly, nothing has been broken. It has just become slow.
That is the correct objection, and the whole subject is built on it. You are right. At any finite number of particles, the exact ground state is the symmetric one, and the exact splitting is non-zero. Symmetry breaking does not happen at some particular finite size. It happens strictly in the limit of infinitely many particles, and the way it happens is that two limits stop commuting.
Two limits, name them.
One is the size of the system going to infinity. The other is a symmetry-breaking perturbation going to zero, an external field, however tiny, that prefers one hand. Now take them in the two possible orders. First, fix the system at finite size and switch the field off completely. Then the tunneling splitting is non-zero. It beats the vanished field, the ground state is symmetric, and the molecule has no handedness. Fine. Now the other order. Keep an infinitesimal field switched on and let the system grow. The splitting is falling exponentially with size. The field is small but fixed, so at some size the field overtakes the splitting, and after that the ground state is a localized, handed state, and it stays handed no matter how much further you grow. Only then do you switch the field off and nothing happens, because the state is stuck.
So the answer to does the system have a handedness depends on the order in which you do two operations that both end in the same place.
Both orders end with an infinite system in zero field, and they give physically different answers. That is not a paradox, and it is not sloppiness. It is the precise mathematical content of the phrase spontaneously broken symmetry, and it is why the phenomenon is genuinely a property of the many-particle limit, rather than an approximation we make because we are lazy. There is nothing in the physics of four atoms that can produce it. There is nothing in the physics of 45 that produces it either, strictly. Sugar is a spectacularly good approximation to it, not the real thing.
Say that again, because you just conceded something.
I did, deliberately. Sugar is not literally in the infinite limit. Its splitting is unimaginably small, but not zero. The exact result belongs to the infinite system, and every real system is an approximation to it. So good an approximation that no experiment will ever detect the difference. And there is a second mechanism at work. Even with no field applied, a real molecule is hit constantly by other molecules, and every collision is effectively a measurement of its shape. That interaction with the environment suppresses the tunneling in its own right. Trost and Hornberger worked it out in 2009 for a small chiral molecule. So two things pin sugar's hand: an exponentially small splitting and an environment that keeps checking.
Then the obvious follow-up, which I have been holding since the first minute: why is all the sugar on Earth the same hand? The two hands are degenerate. Half and half is what I would expect.
And half is what you get. Anderson is explicit about it, and it is the part people skip. He writes that if you synthesize sugar molecules by a chemical reaction more or less in thermal equilibrium, we will find that there are not, on the average, more left than right-handed ones, or vice versa. Make sugar in a flask by ordinary chemistry, and you get an equal mixture, and it does not rotate polarized light at all, because the two halves cancel. And he closes the paragraph: we needed living matter to produce an actual unsymmetry in the populations.
So the glass of sugar water I opened with is not evidence of physics breaking a symmetry. It is evidence of biology having made a choice a very long time ago, and then copying it 4 billion times over.
Biology made the choice. Physics makes it stick. Two separate facts, and the second is the one this series is about. Physics guarantees that once a molecule that size is handed, it stays handed essentially forever. Life is what arranged for all of them to be handed the same way. And we will meet the case where physics does both jobs by itself. A crystal, cooling. But that is a conversation for another day.
Then let us go the other way. You keep saying, make it bigger. I want to know what happens to the problem when you make it bigger. Not the physics, the arithmetic. Because the standard reply is, in principle, we write down the Schrödinger equation for all the particles and solve it. Why is that not the end of the conversation?
Because of one fact about quantum mechanics that has no classical counterpart and that people systematically fail to feel. Take the simplest quantum object there is, a spin that can be up or down, which is the ammonia doublet again, wearing its third costume of the hour. Two states. Now take two of them. Up, 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 down, down, up, down, down. Four states. Three spins, eight. The number of states is 2 multiplied by itself, once for each spin. 2 to the power n.
Which is exponential. And exponentials are alarming in a way people nod along to without ever doing the arithmetic. Do the arithmetic on me.
Gladly, and it is worth doing once in your life. How many of those spins before the number of states in the Hilbert space exceeds the number of atoms in the observable universe, which is about 10 to the 80th?
I have no intuition for this at all, which is exactly your point. I will guess something like 1 million.
270.
270 spins.
270 little arrows, each pointing up or down. And to write down a general quantum state of that system, you need more numbers than there are atoms in the universe. Not more than we can store. More than there are places to store them, at one number per atom, and a cubic centimeter of solid, a lump you can hold between finger and thumb, is 10 to the 23 atoms. A single grain of salt is about 10 to the 18. So the state space of one grain of salt is 2 raised to the power of 10 to the 18. That number has no name, and there is no analogy for it. This is the exponential wall, and it is not an engineering problem that better hardware fixes. Moore's law adds a spin every couple of years.
Give me the real numbers then. What can people actually solve exactly today?
For a lattice of interacting spins, exact diagonalization, literally building the matrix and finding its lowest eigenvector, reaches about 40 spins routinely, and around 50 in two dimensions on a supercomputer, if you exploit every symmetry. For electrons on a lattice, where each site has 4 possibilities instead of 2, empty, spin up, spin down, or doubly occupied, you reach roughly 20 sites, with a basis of order 100 billion states. 20 sites. That is a patch of crystal, 4 atoms by 5.
And the obvious escape is Monte Carlo. Do not enumerate the states, sample them.
Which works beautifully. For bosons, helium, many spin systems, cold atoms, it gives essentially exact answers for large systems. For fermions, it hits a wall of its own, called the sign problem, and the root of it is Pauli. Swapping 2 identical fermions costs you a minus sign, and those minus signs are precisely what you are trying to average over. The quantity you would like to treat as a probability is not positive. It changes sign from configuration to configuration, and the cancellations mean your statistical error grows exponentially with system size and with inverse temperature. So the exponential comes back in through the window. Matthias Troyer and Uwe Jens Wieser proved in 2005 that solving the sign problem in general would solve every problem in the complexity class NP, a polite way of saying nobody expects a general cure.
But I have heard of methods that beat this, and I do not want to be sold a wall that is not there. Density matrix renormalization group. Tensor networks. Those work.
They work, superbly, and the reason they work is the interesting part. They do not defeat the exponential. They exploit the fact that nature does not use the space. Almost every state in that unthinkable Hilbert space is one no real material ever occupies. The ground states of ordinary matter huddle together in a vanishingly thin sliver of it, and these methods parameterize only the sliver. In one dimension, that is a theorem and a triumph. In two dimensions, it is still a conjecture and much harder, and for the model we most want, a doped Hubbard model, it is genuinely open. The wall is real, there are real ladders over parts of it, and the important parts are still standing.
Which is roughly what Dirac said, and he said it very early.
1929, in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, in a paper on many electron systems, verbatim. The underlying physical laws necessary for the mathematical theory of a large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus completely known, and the difficulty is only that the exact application of these laws leads to equations much too complicated to be soluble. That is the reductionist position, and it has not changed in nearly a century. The laws are known. The equations are too hard.
Here is where I want to be obstinate, because Dirac's version sounds like a complaint about computers, and Anderson's claim was about nature. So grant me a magic machine. It has infinite memory, no sign problem, and it has just handed me the exact ground state wave function of 10 to the 23 electrons and ions in a lump of lead at 1 Kelvin. What have I not got?
You have not got superconductivity. And I mean that literally, in 3 ways, the third of which is the one that matters.
Take them in order.
First, and most shallowly, you have a list, an unimaginably long list of complex numbers. Nothing in a list of numbers says, the electrons have paired up, or the pairs all share a single quantum phase, or a magnetic field is expelled from the interior. Those are concepts. You would have to possess them already to know what to ask your list. Nobody extracts a concept from a data structure by staring at it.
Which sounds like it is about us and our limited imaginations, not about the lead.
It does, which is why I said it was the shallow version. Second, history actually ran this experiment. Superconductivity was discovered by Kamerlingh Onnes in 1911. The quantum mechanics needed to explain it was complete by about 1928. The explanation arrived in 1957 from Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. Anderson makes exactly this point. 30 years elapsed, he says, between physicists possessing every fundamental law necessary and the thing being done. And it was not 30 years of arithmetic, it was 30 years of not having the right idea.
And the third way, the one that is about the lead and not about us.
The third is the sharp one, and it comes straight back to ammonia. The defining properties of a superconductor do not exist in any finite system. Take the transition itself. The fact that there is a temperature at which the material stops being a metal and starts being a superconductor abruptly. Li and Yang proved in 1952 that the free energy of any finite system is a perfectly smooth function of temperature. No kinks, no corners, no sharp transition. Ever.
Stop! Why not? That is an extremely strong claim about every finite system in the universe. Give me the reason, not the theorem.
The reason is almost embarrassingly simple. The partition function of a finite system is a sum over its states. Finitely many terms, each one a smooth positive exponential. Add up finitely many smooth positive curves, and what you get is a smooth curve. You cannot manufacture a corner that way. Corners need infinitely many terms. What Li and Yang did was show how the corner assembles. They tracked the zeros of the partition function out in the complex plane, and as the particle number grows, those zeros crowd in towards the real temperature axis and pinch it only in the limit. I am skipping that machinery. What it would have shown you is the corner forming, particle by particle.
So the transition is not merely hard to see in a finite system, it is absent. And that is the second time this hour the new thing has turned out to live in the limit rather than in any of the members.
The second time, and not the last. Singular behaviour appears only in the limit of infinitely many particles, exactly as the broken symmetry did. So when you ask your magic machine about a finite lump of lead, you are asking it about a system that, strictly, does not have the property you want explained. The phenomenon is a property of the limit. It is not in the parts, and it is not in any finite collection of the parts. Anderson puts it as a pair of impossibilities. To synthesize this behavior from the fundamental laws and a computer, we would have to do two impossible things: solve a problem with infinitely many bodies, and then apply the result to a finite system.
Let me try to say that back in one breath, because if I can do that, I have got the argument. Solving the microscopic Hamiltonian would not hand me superconductivity because, one, I cannot solve it, two, even solved, the answer is numbers and not concepts, and history shows the concepts were the hard part, and three, the real one, the property I want explained is a property of the infinite limit, and it is mathematically not present in any finite answer, however exact.
That is it exactly. And the third point is what turns Anderson's essay from an opinion into physics. New law at each level is not a slogan about complexity being mysterious. It is the observation that certain properties are properties of limits, and limits are not contained in any finite member of the sequence.
Then I want the constructive half. It is fine to say the microscopic theory cannot get there. What does get there? What is an effective theory, said properly?
An effective theory is a description that keeps only the degrees of freedom that survive at the scale you care about and packages everything else into a handful of numbers. Take the most familiar one. Hit the end of an aluminium rod. A pulse travels down it. What is its speed?
Sound speed. Square root of a stiffness divided by a density.
Take Young's modulus of aluminium, about 70 gigapascals, divide by its density, about 2700 kilograms per cubic meter. Take the square root, and you get about 5000 meters per second, which is what a pulse in an aluminium rod actually does. Now look at what is in that calculation. Two numbers, no electrons, no nuclei, no Schrödinger equation, nothing about aluminium except a stiffness and a density.
And it is not an approximation to a microscopic calculation that somebody did. Nobody got the sound speed of aluminium by tracking 10 to the 23 atoms.
Nobody ever has, and nobody ever will. And here is the claim I want to defend, because it sounds like showmanship and is not. The effective theory is more predictive than the fundamental one. Three reasons. One, it produces numbers you can check, and the fundamental theory in practice produces nothing at all. Two, it transfers. That same square root works for steel, glass, rock, a material nobody has ever computed, because the derivation never used anything specific. Three, and this is the deep one, it tells you which questions are answerable at this scale and which are not. Knowledge the microscopic theory cannot give you, because it thinks every detail matters.
Where is the cost? Nothing is free.
The cost is real. An effective theory does not compute its own coefficients. It cannot tell you Young's modulus of aluminium. You measure it, or you go down a level and calculate it, which is hard. And it has a range of validity it does not announce. Push the frequency up until the wavelength is a few atoms across, and the formula fails, because a continuous elastic medium is the wrong picture. So it buys enormous predictive power over a stated domain, at the price of a few numbers you must get from elsewhere, and a boundary you must find by other means.
Now push it harder. Sound is a bit tame. Give me an effective theory concept that is genuinely not present anywhere in the microscopic laws.
Rigidity.
Why does a steel bar resist being sheared? There is nothing in the Coulomb interaction between two ions that says resist shear. Shear resistance requires that the atoms have collectively agreed on a set of positions and are all holding those relationships, so the body can only respond as a whole. Anderson's phrasing is exact, because the parts find it energetically more favorable to maintain certain fixed relationships with each other. The symmetry allows only the body as a whole to respond to external forces. This leads to a rigidity.
And he says something surprising immediately after that, doesn't he? That superconductivity and superfluidity are also rigidity.
He does.
Rigidity is also an apt description of superconductivity and superfluidity in spite of their apparent fluid behavior. That is one of the great unifications in the subject, and we will spend a whole conversation on it. The one-line version, a solid resists shear because it has fixed its atomic positions and stiffened against changing them. A superconductor carries current forever because it has fixed a quantum phase and stiffened against changing that. Same idea, different broken symmetry. And in the same passage, he says the leftover of a broken symmetry shows up as long wavelength vibrations, of which the familiar example is sound waves.
So, sound itself, the thing I just used as a tame example, is a consequence of a broken symmetry.
Sound is what is left over when a liquid freezes and space stops being translationally symmetric. A single atom has no sound in it. A pair of atoms has no sound in them. Sound is a property of the crowd, and it is lawful. It has its own equation, its own conserved quantities, its own predictions, none of which appear anywhere in the Hamiltonian you started from, which is Anderson's closing line for that whole section. In this case, we can see how the whole becomes not only more than, but very different from the sum of its parts.
Before we go further, I want to close a gap, because from next time onwards, you will be talking about electrons in solids. Give me the fast version of single particle band theory. Brisk. Just enough that the rest of the course lands.
Brisk it is, and you have already done the hard part today. Start with one atom. An electron bound to it has discrete energy levels, a particle in a well. Now bring a second atom close. What happens to a level?
It splits in two, because now there are two wells and the electron can tunnel between them. And that is exactly the ammonia problem. Two degenerate states coupled by tunneling give you an even and an odd combination, split by twice the coupling.
Identical physics, and in chemistry the two combinations have names. Bonding and antibonding. Now do it with 100 atoms in a row. 100 wells, 100 levels smeared across a range of energies. Do it with 10 to the 23, and you cannot resolve them at all. That smear is a band, and its width is set by one number. How easily an electron leaks from one atom to its neighbor. Call it the hopping. Wide overlap, wide band. Tight orbitals, narrow band. That is tight binding on one parameter.
And the hopping is the same physical quantity as the tunneling amplitude we have been talking about all hour.
The same quantity in different clothes. Now the second ingredient, the one that makes a crystal more than a lot of atoms. The lattice is periodic. Felix Bloch showed in 1928 what periodicity does to the stationary states. They are not localized on atoms at all. They are waves running through the entire crystal, and each is labeled by a crystal momentum, the label that takes over once the lattice has spoiled ordinary momentum conservation.
And the consequence people always underline is the strange one.
A perfect periodic lattice does not scatter an electron at all. Zero resistance. An electron in an ideal crystal propagates forever. The lattice sets which states exist, but it does not impede the motion. So resistance is not caused by electrons bumping into atoms. It is caused by departures from perfection, impurities, defects, boundaries, and the thermal vibrations of the lattice.
Then plot energy against crystal momentum, and you get the band structure and gaps open in it wherever the electron's wavelength is right to Bragg reflect off the lattice planes. So whole ranges of energy are simply forbidden. Band, where the levels are, gap, where they are not. Now fill it up.
And this is where Pauli does the work. Electrons are fermions, two per state, no more. So you pour them into the band structure from the bottom. The energy of the highest occupied state is the Fermi energy, and the surface in momentum space dividing occupied from empty states is the Fermi surface. Picture it as a shoreline. The sea is full of electrons, the land above is empty, and every interesting thing a metal does happens at the water's edge.
And the shoreline is the only place anything can happen. An electron deep in the sea has no empty state to move into. Give me copper.
Copper has about 10 to the 23 conduction electrons per cubic centimetre, roughly one per atom. Its Fermi energy is 7 electron volts. Express that as a temperature and you get about 80,000 Kelvin.
80,000. And a room is 300. So, thermally, the electron C in a copper wire in this room is essentially at zero temperature.
Essentially frozen. Only the electrons within a sliver of the Fermi surface, a fraction of order room temperature over 80,000 Kelvin, so about a third of a percent, have any empty states to move into. Everyone else is locked in by Pauli. Hold on to that fraction. Almost everything a metal does is decided by a thin shell of states, not by the whole sea.
And metal versus insulator falls out of how the filling lands.
Partly filled band, and there are empty states and infinitesimal energy above the occupied ones, so a field can accelerate electrons and you have a metal. Completely filled band with a gap above it, nowhere to go without paying the gap, and a weak field does nothing, an insulator. Alan Wilson set that out in 1931. Every transistor ever fabricated is downstream of that sentence.
Right, I have bands, gaps, a Fermi C and a Fermi surface, and I can tell a metal from an insulator. And now you are going to tell me something is badly wrong with all of it.
Something is badly wrong with all of it, and the wrongness is quantitative. So I'm going to hand you the ingredients rather than the answer. Everything I just described treats each electron as if it were alone in the crystal, moving in a fixed periodic potential. Nowhere did any electron notice any other electron. So tested. In copper, the conduction electrons are packed at about 10 to the 23 per cubic centimeter. How far apart is a typical pair?
Volume per electron is 10 to the minus 23 cubic centimeters, so the spacing is the cube root of that, about 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, a couple of angstroms.
About 2.3. Now price the Coulomb repulsion between two electrons sitting that far apart.
Two charges, an angstrom or two apart, is an atomic scale energy, the same order as a chemical bond. So several electron volts, call it six.
Six is right.
Then I have a problem because you told me the Fermi energy of copper is seven. Those are the same number. The interaction I was invited to ignore is the size of the entire kinetic energy of the system. There is no small parameter anywhere. It is not a weak perturbation sitting on top of a solved problem. What we threw away is as big as what we kept.
That is the situation, and there is a second thing that makes it worse. We said a perfect lattice does not cause resistance because the electron waves sail straight through it. True. But nothing we have said all hour concerns electrons scattering off each other, and periodicity gives you no protection whatsoever against that. Every one of those 10 to the 23 electrons is being shoved, continuously, by every other one, with an energy comparable to its own.
Then let me predict something, so it can be wrong. If every electron is being shoved that hard, the sharp single particle levels ought to smear out. No well-defined energy for a given momentum, no crisp Fermi surface, and none of the band structure we just built should survive.
That is the prediction the numbers make, and it is why the observation is so strange. Knock electrons out of a copper crystal with ultraviolet light, measure the energy and angle they leave with, and you reconstruct the energy versus momentum relation they had inside. What comes back is not a smear. It is a sharp peak tracking a band, and it sharpens as you approach the Fermi surface. Something is protecting these electrons from each other, and naming that something is a whole conversation of its own, and it is coming shortly.
Then the single particle picture should be garbage, and it is not garbage. It is the foundation of the entire semiconductor industry.
It is not merely not garbage.
For a simple metal, it is quantitatively good to a few percent, and those peaks sit exactly where a theory with no interactions at all says they should. A copper wire behaves as though its electrons barely speak to one another, while every one of them is being shouted at. That is the scandal, and it is the central puzzle of the first act.
So that is question one.
Question one. Why do metals work? Why does a theory that ignores a strong interaction describe a strongly interacting system? The answer belongs to Lev Landau in 1957. It is called Fermi liquid theory, and the short version, the electrons do not stay electrons. They dress themselves in the disturbance they create. Each drags a cloud of displaced charge with it, and that composite, electron plus cloud, is a quasiparticle. Quasiparticles are heavier than bare electrons. They have a finite lifetime, and near the Fermi surface, that lifetime becomes long enough that they behave like well-defined particles. The old picture survives, but with renormalized contents.
And that is testable, presumably, not just a comforting story.
Extremely testable, and we do it properly two conversations from now. It predicts that the electrical resistivity of a clean metal rises as the square of temperature at low temperature. That specific power, for a specific reason to do with how many quasiparticles can scatter off each other while respecting Pauli. It predicts a heat capacity linear in temperature with a coefficient set by the effective mass. And angle-resolved photo emission, the probe you just met, lets you look straight at that quasi-particle peak and measure how its weight and width behave near the Fermi surface.
And question two is the one this whole hour has been circling.
Question two, why does order appear?
Take almost any material, cool it, and at some sharp temperature, it stops being one thing and becomes another. Iron cooling through its Curie point, a little over 1,000 Kelvin. Above it, a lump of metal with no magnetic direction. Below it, every atomic moment has agreed on a direction, and the lump is a magnet. Nothing in the Hamiltonian picked that direction. The system picked it.
Which is the ammonia story again, with 10 to the 23 participants instead of 4 atoms.
Same skeleton. And if that were all it was, this series would be one conversation long. 3 things are genuinely new. Iron has a sharp transition at a definite temperature. Sugar has no critical point at all. It is simply stuck. Sugar chose between 2 options. Iron chooses from a continuous family, every direction in space, so it can point one way here and slightly differently a millimeter over. And because of that, it has excitations no molecule can have. Long, slow twists of the ordering direction that cost almost nothing. Plus a rigidity that makes the whole lump respond as one body. That is what acts 2 through 4 are for.
And the same machinery covers superfluids and superconductors, which are the 2 showpieces.
Helium-4, cooled below about 2 Kelvin, which flows without viscosity and climbs up and over the walls of its container in a film about 30 nanometers thick. Lead, cooled below 7 Kelvin, which carries a current forever and pushes a magnetic field bodily out of its own interior, which, with flux pinning to hold it in place, is why a magnet hovers in mid-air over a cooled ceramic, one of the few laboratory demonstrations that looks like a conjuring trick. And then, later on, the idea that explains why a magnet at its critical point and a fluid at its critical point, systems with nothing physically in common, obey numerically identical laws near the transition. That is universality, and it is the deepest reason effective theories are entitled to work.
You have also promised, somewhere in that list, order that is not this kind of order at all.
That is Act 3, and it is the strangest thing in the subject.
There are states of matter demonstrably distinct from one another, with no broken symmetry and no order parameter. No quantity measuring how much of a choice the system has made, because it has not made one. What distinguishes them is a global topological property of the quantum states themselves, and the observable consequence is an integer. In the quantum Hall effect, you measure that integer as a ratio of a voltage to a current, and it comes out quantized to a few parts in a billion, in a dirty semiconductor sample, at finite temperature. Precision like that out of a messy system is not something the ordinary rules prepare you for, and the reason is that an integer cannot change a little bit.
Then mark what is not understood.
The cuprate superconductors, discovered by Bednorz and Müller in 1986, superconduct at temperatures the 1957 theory says should be impossible, and after 4 decades, there is no accepted explanation. In their normal state, above the transition, their resistivity rises linearly in temperature, over an enormous range, which flatly contradicts the temperature squared law that Fermi liquid theory predicts. So the first act's triumph fails there, and we do not know what replaces it. Quantum spin liquids, where the spins are conjectured to remain disordered and entangled all the way to absolute zero, are still argued about material by material. Those are where this series ends, and I am not going to pretend they resolve.
Then let me hold the whole hour, because it comes down to 3 things, and I want to say them in my own words. First, solving the microscopic Hamiltonian would not give me superconductivity, not because the sums are hard, though they are, but because the thing I want explained is a property of the infinite particle limit, and it is mathematically absent from any finite answer.
And the finite answer would be a list of numbers, and the concepts were always the hard part. Yes.
Second, an effective theory is a description that keeps only the degrees of freedom that matter at my scale, and hides everything else in a few measured numbers. And it can outpredict the fundamental theory because it actually yields checkable numbers, because it transfers to systems nobody has ever computed, and because it tells me which questions are even askable. The price is that it does not generate its own coefficients, and it has a boundary I have to find by other means.
That is exactly right. And later in the series, we will show you why nature is entitled to let you get away with it.
And third, the two great questions. Why do metals work when the interaction we ignore is as large as everything we keep? And why does order appear when nothing in the laws prefers any particular order? Act 1 is the first. Acts 2 through 4 are the second.
That is the course. And Anderson gets the last word because he ends the paper with a joke, and the joke is the argument. He notes that Marx said quantitative differences become qualitative ones, then says a Paris conversation of the 1920s puts it better. Fitzgerald: the rich are different from us. Hemingway: yes, they have more money. The exchange almost certainly never happened in that form, but the physics is right. More is not a bigger amount of the same. More is different.
So, what do we need before we can do any of this?
A language. And this is a real obstacle, not a formality. Everything today has been about 10 to the 23 identical particles, and the notation you learned quantum mechanics in. This electron here, that one there, is unusable because there is no such thing as this electron. Every state has to be anti-symmetrized across every particle, and the bookkeeping defeats you before you write anything interesting.
So we stop tracking who is where.
We stop tracking who entirely and start counting how many. How many particles in this state, how many in that. Then we build two operators whose whole job is to change those counts by one. One that adds a particle to a state, one that removes it, and if you demand the right behavior when you swap two particles, the Pauli exclusion principle falls out of an algebraic identity rather than being imposed by hand. That is second quantization. Dirac had the idea in 1927.
And with that in hand, you can write down the simplest, genuinely hard problem in the subject.
The Hubbard model. Electrons on a lattice with exactly two terms, one that lets an electron hop to a neighboring site, the same hopping we met in the band picture, and one that charges an energy penalty whenever two electrons end up on the same site. That is the entire model. Two terms. It has been studied for more than 60 years. It is believed to contain magnetism and the Mott insulator, and possibly high-temperature superconductivity. And in two dimensions, nobody has solved it.
Two terms, 6 decades, unsolved. That is the next hour.
That is the next hour. Bring the operators. We will build them from scratch.